Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 67 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So before we begin, I would just like to thank Lene for stepping in last week when I could not comfortably speak. I did have a raging case of strep throat, which is now gone, so I'm happy to be back. But again, thank you so much, Lene, for helping me out in my time of need. Announcements this week. We got a couple of new pictures from the Outlander Stars Instagram account. We got two new shots from the Outlander Stars Instagram account this week. The first of a solo shot of Kate with her behind-the-scenes crew getting her ready for a shot. And then we also got a behind-the-scenes shot of Katrina and Tobias at the railway station with their goodbye scene.
I think that was the Bowness railway station that they redid for the 40s. They dressed for the 40s.
Lovely shots. And we also found out this week that, and not surprisingly, I should say, that Audiophile magazine put out their best voices of 2014, and our very own Davina Porter made the list for...
It's their issue called 2020, the Year in Audiobooks 2014. And yes, Davina made the list of best voices, which we are... very happy to hear, as she always deserves it. So the two works listed under her name are Elizabeth is Missing by Emma Healy and Written in My Own Heart's Blood, of course, by Diana Gabaldon.
So congratulations, Ms. Porter. And that is announcements this week. So we will move on to our read-along of Dragonfly and Amber, Chapter 7, entitled...
Royal Audience. This chapter opens in Paris at Jared's home in the Rue Tremoulin. I like how Diana's description, she goes out of her way to mention how close the houses were and that, quote, a reasonably athletic burglar could have leaped from rooftop to rooftop with no difficulty. And I think it's an amusing description anyway, but having read it a few times and coming back, the book a few times and coming back and reading this, this is the first time it stuck out to me, but you may find this funny later on. Murta says, I'll find my own lodging. And Jamie jokes that if he's too uncomfortable to sleep under a roof, that he's welcome to the stables. We find out that Jared isn't married, though of course he has a mistress. Jamie explains, like, well, that's don't be silly.
It's like one in France.
Jared thinks Claire is very decorative, but that Jamie must buy her a new gown. So she's apparently still wearing Annabelle McGranick's, which is like... she may have another one, too, but the only quote-unquote nice gown she has, I think, is the one she has from Mrs. McGranick. And it's a little worse for the wear.
Well, not only that, but she stated that Annabelle McGranick was also built like...
a shovel.
A shovel, which means to say she was not curvy and very thin.
Jamie says that he is to go out with Jared and go over some of his ledgers and meet some of his clients. He asks Claire if she'll be all right on her own, and she says she will be, and that she'll explore the house and become acquainted with the servants. So Claire's narrative tells the reader more about their backstory. They were barred from Scotland and needed to find a place to make their future, Europe or America. Jamie had bad seasickness, so a long voyage by sea wasn't in the cards. So France it was. We also learn of the Frasers' strong ties to France, many of them living in France, and many Jacobites who had left Scotland to await their king's restoration.
Which, that's not too surprising that there would be a lot of Frasers in France, because their motto is Je suis prêt.
We learn from Jamie that his upbringing between the Mackenzies and the Frasers, his time spent in French society and in the army, that he didn't have a chance to not understand politics. To put that better, to survive, he had to be able to understand politics from a young age, basically. He really had to do this to survive. He says, you don't spend time in these places, quote, without learning how to listen and what's being said and what's being meant and how to tell the difference between the two. Jamie also says that when talk, really of any kind, perhaps, but specifically the talk of the Jacobites, made it from the houses to the tavern, you'll know it's serious. Claire likens her having to direct the servants as when she was stationed in the French Field Hospital in 1943. She's not looking forward to really, or she's maybe out of her element, she thinks, in having to direct a full house full of servants or staff. But she remembers, you know, I've done something kind of similar in the past or in the future, and it should be fine. And that was under much more stress.
But in the first book, she even stated she'd never even had her own home, really. So to be in someone else's home, but overseeing all of their servants, I would think that that would be daunting, to say the least.
Well, daunting and awkward. I think she didn't bring up the home part here much. I took the emphasis to be more on, I've never directed this type of people, servants, but she makes comparison to when she had actually been barking out orders as a senior nurse, so she does have some kind of experience, and so that kind of gives her a little more confidence. Ellen G. says, mention of Claire's stationing in France during the war, do we know where exactly? Is that where she learned to speak French? You know, that's a good question. We don't necessarily know. She could very well have learned it as she grew up with Uncle Lamb. She may have learned it in school, but I don't know that we know exactly where she had been stationed. So Claire meets the staff, there are 16 of them, and is amazed that they are paid so little. While she was getting to know the house and the staff, Jamie was out with Jared doing business and also preparing himself to, quote, assist His Highness, as Diana writes. Claire overhears a maid say the name Saint-Germain and confirms that she means the Comte. She says that he has a very bad reputation. He sold his soul to the devil, celebrates the Black Mass, and shares the blood and flesh of innocent children, according to the maid Marguerite. Apparently this doesn't matter. Women continue to throw themselves at him. So Ellen G. makes a very important remark, which you could read into it, that he is good-looking, or at least is appealing.
Nope. He's rich.
And the next line is, and he's rich. So, Ellen, you could be right, because the statement of women throwing themselves at him came before the justification of him being rich. Because it came first, it doesn't mean that he is or he isn't. But at this point, I don't believe we have a lot of description of how he looks, or at least of him being extremely good looking or extremely bad looking. Either way, the rich is going to help either way. So the rich may be a main reason. Regardless of his reputation, women are throwing themselves at him.
In Claire's brain, she goes, plainly this last qualification of, but then he is rich, was at least sufficient to balance, if not to outweigh, the blood drinking and flesh eating.
It has more to do with balancing his reputation. That statement is talking about the money makes up for his reputation. There's nothing in there about how he looks. As far as that goes. But we still don't know. There's no evidence in there to say that he's good looking. So Ellen, we don't know. But the rich...
I imagine he comes up again in the book, so maybe there'll be more descriptions
he
then.
He may be back. She also says that the reason Jared has invited the Comte to dinner is, quote, so he can serve the best, he meaning Jared, so he can serve the best bonne, tell him that he has just acquired 10 cases, and then offer him a bottle to take home. In other words, to rub his nose in it. Was that the same wine that he... I mean, likely. Come on. Why else choose this possible one? That's my guess. So that evening, Jared is rehearsing with Jamie before he leaves on his trip. The most important thing for them to go over was the king's levée at Versailles. Being invited was a mark of favor, according to Jared. The king wants to make sure he's coming back from his trip, as apparently the most recent taxes were hard on merchants.
Can I just make a statement? You said the levée?
Levée.
Okay. That makes me think of the soap Lever 2000, which I never made a connection between that and bathing until right now.
Levée is to get up, so his rising. But...
Well, I don't speak French. My point is, okay. Is like, he gets up and then he has his daily ablutions.
Toilet, yeah.
And his toilet, if you will. And it just made me think of Lever 2000, that soap.
I thought you were going to say that you kept reading The King's Lever.
Nope.
Okay, good.
Did not.
This is the meal of eels. It's got a little bit of a reputation, and it's kind of, well, I wouldn't eat it anyway, but I'm vegetarian, so I don't even entertain it. Would you ever eat eels?
I wouldn't like to. I wouldn't like to. I don't know. I would never say never, but I wouldn't like to. But for some reason, even though I know it says eels, I'm always imagining little tentacles, like little
squid.
Like little tiny octopus. I know that's not what it says, but that's what I'm seeing in my head every time I read it.
Like suckers?
Yeah, like little tentacles.
I don't even know if that's worse or better. Jared mentions his plans for Jamie to accompany him to Montmartre to meet Prince Charles. Jamie and Claire's eyes meet. And so it begins.
Isn't the Moulin Rouge a Montmartre?
I don't know. But I know Montmartre also played somewhere in the story of Les Miserables. So who knows? So Charles basically doesn't go out much. It wouldn't be appropriate, Jared says, until or unless the king receives him officially. Claire says, that isn't what I've heard. And both men are startled. She says she's heard from the servants. That's like a whole lot of servants, although it only comes to her through one person, that the prince has been paying calls on the Princesse Louise de la Tour de Rouen. She's carefully chewing and swallowing the eels, Claire is. Jamie was amused, Jared appalled. Her husband's family are close to the king, he says. This could be dangerous.
I would like to speak more to the fact that he seemed appalled that she was
gossiping
with the chambermaids, and he's like, a lady would never blah blah blah, but he was very excited to get the information.
Well, he
wants the information, but he was like disdainful of the fact that she was speaking to the servants, and I was like, well, how else do you think she got the information, buddy?
What else does she have to do all day? Right, leave her at home. So Jared gives Jamie his first assignment: befriend the prince, help him meet men that may be of use to him, and warn him of danger he may be getting into. Jamie asks how the kitchen maid knows all of this information, and Claire tells him, I guess them, about the hearsay. She heard it from him, who heard it from her, who heard it from him, and so on and so forth. And this is when Jared says, ladies do not gossip with the kitchen maids, with their kitchen maids. And that reminds me of, with the emphasis on the word not that I just put, reminds me of a line, it's at least in the musical, I don't think it's in the book, from Phantom of the Opera, when Carlotta says, this thing will not happen. Remember that? It's there, I promise. In her Italian accent. Ellen G. writes, I love that Claire listens to the gossip around the house. Did Jamie ever expect her to get information for him that way? Or did he want her to court the people in society? Which she's apparently not allowed into yet.
Right.
Or hasn't been taken into yet.
I noticed more to the fact that when Jared made the statement of, ladies do not blah, 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 that Jamie's, like, his mouth twitched because he's partially insulted on Claire's behalf that he's basically calling her not a lady. But
also, like, she's not a lady.
Right.
Jamie changes the topic to the shipment of rum on its way from Jamaica. And I did have a little, like, a ping, ping, ping in the back of my head, but I thought, you know, not going to say anything yet. Ellen said it, though, and I said, okay, so if someone else picked up on it, and I'm sure others did, too, I will mention it. Ellen writes, the first mention of Jamaica. Interesting. Planting the seeds? And I did a quick search, and actually Jamaica is mentioned in the chapter when they're going down to the docks and he's talking about where a ship will be coming in from or going to. So it is mentioned, but this is the first time that Jamie brings it up, and that it's really going to be a topic of conversation at their table that we know of. Claire excuses herself to lie down, and she keeps imagining eels. She goes through almost like a meditation, but her meditation brings her back to eels. So it's not a very effective one, Claire. Jamie joins her, and they discuss the possible French financing of the uprising. Now, in the interim, Jamie joined her after smoking with Jared. He comes back to the room, stinking of the smoke, reeking of the smoke, and he hangs his shirt up, like, out the window. And comes to bed, I think, only in his kilt and socks, kilt and hose. And it's still in his hair, but she can stand that, apparently. James and Charles will likely be looking at more than just Louis. So James, the father, Charles, the son, the French baking families, the Vatican, and the Spanish court. And that was banking families, not baking families.
I'm like,
families.
Did you just say baking?
Hey, the French are great bakers. Do not talk badly about them.
Yeah, but I don't think they're on the same level as the king.
French banking families are on the same level as the French baking families. But James got money from Spain years ago for the ill-fated 1715 uprising. So that may not be another go-to source, is what maybe we're supposed to understand, or not at least a guaranteed source. After Jamie meets Charles for the first time and comes back, Claire asks him what it was like. Jamie says, well, he had a toothache. But then he goes on to say exactly what transpired, how many times he did this, what he did, what he said, how, I mean, I'm like, dang, Jamie, you just like, you know, he's a good, because he kind of is a spy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's not necessarily reporting to anyone, but he's keeping an eye out. So he's good at what he does. And he's at least telling Claire right now. And he just, like, recounted the entire evening. Oh, he likes hunting, but he prefers this type of hunting. And, oh, am I good with an arrow? Oh, I like this. And, oh, I hope that when we get back to Scotland, I can invite you on a hunt. I'm like, man, it's almost like stream of consciousness. But there are periods, and he does take a breath. Claire was a little disappointed at this report, but at least Jamie had been invited back. On to the king's lover. I mean, Levé. A, quote, favored few chosen to attend the king's toilette as he greeted the new day. Jamie leaves at 0:30 and returns around tea time. He describes the day's events to her. When he'd knelt before the king to say good morning, the latter had said, big, aren't you? Yes, Jamie had said. And then, can you dance? To which Jamie said he could. And then this line just made me laugh. Quote, all the bitty wee comte and duke all glancing at me out of the sides of their eyes as though Scottishness were catching.
This whole scene was just awkward to me. I was like, yeah. I could not imagine having to be present at something like that and or being the person having that's that morning watched. That's being watched by literally everyone.
I don't know which is worse. Having to be the one to wipe him is probably the worst, although apparently it was a great honor.
Y'all, it's bad enough having a six-year-old who follows you into the bathroom every 5 seconds. You can't have a bathroom time to yourself. I can't imagine having that be every day and like 20 or 30 people.
Diana writes, Jamie had by now thrown himself on the floor and was doing the Royal Air Force exercises I had recommended to strengthen the muscles of his back. And that, first of all, it's very comical. This 18th century Scot doing these things that I have seen in black and white footage of videos from World War II soldiers, at least American soldiers. I tried to find something. I did a quick search for RAF. I was not successful. I did a search for United States Army exercises, video, that kind of thing. There are all kinds of videos out there. I couldn't find an exact spot in a much longer video that had them doing like calisthenics or something. But I think most of us have seen things like that. And that's exactly what came to my mind. I don't know why this makes me laugh, but it does. This imagery of this big, beautiful Scot on the ground doing these World War II era exercises.
So, quick question.
Uh-huh.
Now that we've been watching the first half of this season.
Yeah.
Do you now imagine Sam when you read?
I haven't yet.
You haven't?
Nope. I'm not thinking it. When I was reading this, I didn't think of Sam on the floor doing exercises. I don't. It hasn't melted over yet. Maybe I'm just
melted
able.
Melted over for me during the last read-along, but whatever.
Last read-along, you weren't part of it. Do you mean no. Chapter 5?
I mean, the first read-along we did, the book, first book.
Oh, before the series started?
Yes.
Oh, got it. Referring to the remark, tight as an owl, Jamie informs Claire, but they have got arseholes. I knocked one out of a tree once we a slingshot and looked. The more you know.
And then and he looked, and then he made Ian hang out with him under that tree just to make sure that something came out of that
end. Of a southern region, yes. And it's touching that he is a little sad when he remembers that Ian could run like the wind. It is kind of, I mean, it's very, because we don't meet, at least in the book so far, in the main series, we don't meet Ian before he had his accident or he had his injury. We see more of the Christ-like figure of Jamie. Though perhaps not as outwardly obvious as an outlander, Jamie says he was born to something. Being a laird, he feels responsible to the people he was born to protect, right? But he's no longer there. He's no longer allowed in his own country, basically. And now, in the situation that they're in, he wants nothing more than to take Claire and the baby and just go far away, work the land, be whatever he needs to be to protect them and just live a simple life, basically. He wants to be with them and keep them safe. And even though I may be making too many connections again, but just as Christ said, and I looked it up, it's Luke 22:42. Father, if you are willing, take this cup of suffering from me. Even though Jamie knows what he wants, what he would prefer, he's many, many miles away from the people he was born to protect and serve, basically. He still has a duty because of his relationship with Claire and the knowledge that they have and what they've agreed to do. He still feels duty-bound to do what they can to stop the rising.
Well, and
or at least for the to make picture, for... Well, the larger picture, but also for his people.
Well, it is for his people, but if you look back and you think about it, he can't be on Scottish soil physically helping at the farm and helping with his hands in that way. What he can do...
Is this.
So that's what he... That's the only way that he feels that he can fulfill his duties as the Laird.
And that's why I make the connection between what Christ said in the garden and what he's saying is Christ was not shirking his responsibility or what he was born into. He knew what he was born into, but he was saying, if there's any way that I can, you know, maybe not do this, just, you know, let me know. And Jamie is like, I want nothing more. And it's not about cowardice. It's about just wanting to, like, I have been through the ringer. I have been through this and that, and I just want to live with you, love you, protect our baby, and just make a life, because this is something that is, I feel compelled to do. We both, actually, they both do. He knows what he will do, and that is at least to go along this path, but doesn't mean that he wouldn't like to do something else. And that kind of wraps up the chapter.
Really?
That's where it ends. They agree that they can only do their best.
You're right. That is the end of chapter 7.
And that wraps up our Chapter 7 read-along. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.